Welcome to episode 2 of ReWrap Podcast, where we talk about all things photo, video, mobile, and the creative lifestyle. My name is Jaron Schneider, and joining me as usual is the man known for the squinch, Karyman Dragooman.
Hello.
And also joining us today, we have a special guest, is famed retoucher Pratik Nayak.
Well, hello.
Very, very happy to have you, Pratik. So Pratik is going to join us today, and we're going to talk with him about everything we would normally cover in this podcast. But specifically, we've asked him to come on and discuss Affinity Photo, that free beta app that is supposed to compete with Photoshop. So we'll see how that actually happens. But first, let's go over a little bit of news, just a couple things. The first thing that I wanted to talk about was Lytro's major pivot, $50 million pivot towards virtual reality, which also caused them to fire between 20 and 50, it's unconfirmed right now, and they're not public, so they don't really have to say, but 20 and 50 people, and completely alter their business model. And this came to me as a shock. I mean, I don't know. What did you guys think about this, Karyminder?
I know a lot of people who work at Lytro, and I just instantly felt horrible for them, and just feel like the management never really, you hear stories, and it just felt like this is kind of not surprising from the way management's already been behaving. I mean, this is what I understand and know, but it sucks. And I thought that, you know, they came out with a product, the Illum, a second product, and was really hopeful that they could take this somewhere. It's cool technology. Unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever get to see that.
Yeah, I agree. I also know some people there. And I had an inside source who chose to remain anonymous who actually told me quite a bit about what it was like to work there, and I wrote that in an editorial. And they just painted this picture of completely like helter-skelter management that really did this. And that's really too bad to hear, especially for a product that I thought had a lot of possibility. What do you think about this, Pratik?
I'm not cool enough to know anybody there like you guys, but I thought that okay. The news was really sad. I think it reflects poorly on the company. Honestly, I was hoping that they would have taken this technology and licensed it, you know, to say Canon, Nikon, or somebody to see this used in a much broader perspective. But I think something like this just tarnishes their name a little bit their decisions. So overall, very sad news for the industry.
Just very unpleasant. Sorry to everyone who is connected to anyone who might have lost their jobs at Lytro or going through all of that. So we extend our feelings towards that direction. Sucks to see. I think anyone in this industry, it sucks to see something like this go down. It could have been absolutely any company here. Like, I felt the same way when Calumet announced that they were going out of business. Like, that sort of thing just goes like, what? Like, I hate seeing guys fail. So this doesn't necessarily mean they failed, I guess, but it sort of kind of does. Like, basically, we're not winning in this industry, therefore we're moving to a different industry. Kind of like,
I'm not sure they were actually ever trying, Jaron. I mean, from everything I hear, I don't think
it was like a mix of trying and not trying simultaneously. If you guys haven't, if you're listening to this and you haven't read my interview with my anonymous source from Lytro, they really do paint the picture of what it's like there. So make sure you go check that out on resourcemagonline.com.
Okay. This other product came out this week. Well, it didn't come out. They made a video and it got all flashy. It's basically called the Konost, KONOST. It's the first true digital rangefinder. Did you guys take a look at this? Did you see this?
Yeah, I mean, it came up on my news feed for sure the first day it came out, and I was just like, what is going on?
Yeah, so these guys, they basically have a mock-up and they made a video around that. They do have a prototype working, but it's not the prototype in the mock-up form. But what it is essentially is a rangefinder is a very like technical, calibrated, German precision engineered product where the lens and the way it moves is also adjust the rangefinder patch to help you focus. It has to be calibrated, and sometimes, you know, it goes out of calibration and you send it in to get calibrated and you get it back. This avoids that by using digital technology, basically a camera, a small little camera with a sensor to help you focus a real rangefinder, like lens on the body, and then you would basically have a rangefinder camera that doesn't need calibration. I've read through their whole website, and essentially they're hoping for this to come out. They do have a prototype that's like a circuit board, very big, nothing portable.
Not so. So what you're saying is the prototype product that they're talking about doesn't exist. The one that they see you see in the videos.
That's a mock-up from Taiwan is what was the language on the website.
So what that means is it doesn't exist.
This is correct. It doesn't exist. And then what they hope for in the future is like this will come out later this year, the full frame. Then they'll have an APS-C version for cheaper. And then they'll have like maybe another APS-C or a smaller sensor size that has a fixed lens for even cheaper. But right now, this is vaporware. I want to see the interesting possibilities. It's kind of a weird shape. I'm a rangefinder guy. I love my rangefinders. This is what I use every day.
Leica M9, right?
Yeah, not the M9, the newer M240, which I had the M9. Great camera. I do hope there's something that good comes out of this. But right now, this website, this company is set up for taking funding so they can achieve their dream and achieve their vision. I kind of hope they do it.
Are their investments, are they looking to crowdfund it, or are they looking for individual? No.
They have a whole section on their website called Investor Corner. And there is basically just says, hey, get in contact with us. That's who they're targeting, this entire website and this media that they've generated for that. And
they're avoiding the kickstart. They're avoiding the popular crowdfund. They want they want real money is what they're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because crowdfunding is nice, but very rarely do you get like an Oculus Rift style explosion of money. Like that's very one in several million that could possibly happen. So I that sounds like they're looking for a Lytro style $50 million infusion.
Yeah. I wonder about like sensor technology. I've stuck with Leica for a long time, and Leica engineered like these micro sites, these micro little photo sites on the sensor to help with super wide angle lenses and getting the light capture just right on a full frame sensor. Leica's first digital rangefinder when it came out was the M8, which was only, I think, a 1.3 crop. So it was smaller than full frame because they didn't think they could do it. Then they finally did it. And now they're evolving on that. I hope that these guys can also do that too and have good quality, good performance.
Yeah, because competition is good.
Yes, they definitely have a lot of work cut out for them.
As does anybody who enters in this kind of industry, which involves sensor technology. Making a sensor is not easy, which is why everyone's buying Sony sensors right now, because it's just like, I mean, one guy's doing it right, why bother trying to reinvent the wheel?
Yeah. Oh, anyway, good luck to them. Hope they do well.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Okay. So next, this is what I'm rubbing my hands together because I've been excited about this. Pratik is going to take us through his review of the new Affinity photo software. So for those of you who don't know what Affinity is, about 2 weeks ago, this really blew up. This is a beta software which is supposed to compete with Photoshop, and based on their very, very flashy video that they put together that shows what it's possible that it can do, it's very, very easy to get excited about something like this. And I also think that people want to be excited about this because they don't want Adobe to be the only player in the game. Right now you have basically Adobe and GIMP, and nobody wants to use GIMP. As a software, Adobe is just really, really ahead of the game, to the point where, like, I mean, Aperture dropped out. What was it last year?
They did. I think they released the news either last year or seemingly maybe 8 months ago or something along those lines. And I think everyone's trying to look for either alternatives or something to make their life a little bit easier.
Yeah, and I think that really stems from Adobe's choice to going to the monthly subscription model rather than being able to purchase it outright.
That's right.
A lot of people are really, really fired up about that. I'm not one of them. I don't care that much. But it's been like the general sentiment that they suck because of that. And I don't know. But
yeah.
That's why Affinity's getting all these hurrahs, because they want this option. So Pratik, walk us through what you liked, what you didn't like, everything you noticed.
Yeah, so, you know, going back on the subscription model, I think Affinity came at the right time because, as you mentioned, there were a lot of people that cared about the fact that you had to rent the software by paying, you know, $9.99 a month or whatever subscription plan you have. And with Affinity, with them being free, or, you know, eventually you'd have to purchase this software for, I think it's $50 once it comes out of beta. It gives people that power back to own a piece of software where you don't have to rent monthly. And they're tapping into that market. Now, I was kind of skeptical when I heard the news about Affinity because I wasn't sure if it was powerful enough, but everyone that I had talked to when they downloaded the beta said that it was pretty powerful and it was legitimate. I was intrigued. So I took a look at it and I was able to run through some images, see the pros and cons of how it operated, and is it something viable that could replace Photoshop? And the answer was maybe, actually, and I'll show you why. So I'm going to load up Affinity, and what we're going to do is basically take a look at an image as we run through it. So I'll load up an image right now. And the cool thing, first and foremost, about Affinity is the layout is very similar to Photoshop, where everything looks very similar. So you're able to get a sense of how it operates right away without having to learn or read a lot about it. So a lot of programs, as you know, are daunting because they have a lot of options. And with a lot of options comes the time that you need to spend learning everything before you jump into it. The power that Affinity has is the fact that you're able to jump in right away just because you've been used to Photoshop. So for me personally, when I loaded up Affinity, it took me about 10 minutes to get familiarized with all the layouts just because I was used to Photoshop and it made it so seamless. I think the main concern I have is how does a company like this get away with having a program that's so similar to Photoshop without being sued? Or how do they mirror everything exactly to the point where they're not worried about Adobe coming after them? I don't know what kind of legalities they are related to software development, but that was kind of something that raised my concern. So here I have Affinity loaded on my computer, and what I'm going to do is open up a RAW file to show you kind of how it looks in comparison to Camera Raw or another program. So you're able to go to File, Open, or Open Recent, and it gives you the option to basically pick any file that's in RAW format. Now, it doesn't load medium format files or things like that yet, from what I have experienced. So there is an issue with compatibility. So say you are a photographer that shoots in a format that you would need Photoshop for, then you would have to convert the file before bringing it into Affinity, which kind of defeats the purpose of having a program altogether. Now, on my screen, I've loaded Affinity. And I've opened up one of the raw files that you kindly sent over, Jaren.
You're welcome.
And so the first thing that I got stuck on was in Photoshop, typically you have something which is the Camera Raw editor. It's very distinct from Photoshop, where a window pops up and you can see that you're able to adjust the settings in your raw file. With Affinity, it doesn't have a separate window. It loads right into the program as if you're going to start retouching it directly. And that kind of throws people into a little loop. So the good thing is that it's all consolidated, but the bad thing is that it's a little bit confusing and you're not really sure that it's the raw file just yet. You think it's kind of a copy of the raw file that just opened directly into the program. So you have to understand that you must be aware that there's a distinction between the raw editor and the actual, what do you call it? The program itself.
So
So
even
first,
though you're in, it looks like you're in editing the photo, but really you're still in the raw editor. You have to finish editing raw and hit like complete somewhere.
exactly. So on the top left corner, there's a button that says commit, and it's not very obvious. So in the top left corner, you must commit to all your changes before you go and start modifying the image at pixel level, so to speak. So here I've opened up one of my raw pictures, and on the right-hand side of the program, you can see all the options that you have. So starting from the top, you have white balance, exposure, black point, contrast, shadows, highlights, clarity, and vibrance. So I think one of the biggest downsides to this program was when you click on, say, white balance, and you start modifying the white balance left or right, it doesn't give you the exact temperature of the white balance. It just gives you percentages. So if you push the white balance to the left, it says, say, minus 20% instead of a Kelvin, which can be it's not precise comparatively to what you're used to. And if you're like me, that I need to know a specific white balance, it's not as obvious. So that's an issue. The second issue is that it's very similar throughout all the other options. So even exposure doesn't have numbers, it has percentages. and it's not really favorable to me, especially if you're used to knowing exactly what exposure you're supposed to be at or what white balance you're supposed to be at. So that's kind of the downside. The second issue that I noticed right away is some of the processing is very rudimentary. So say I come over to the highlights and shadows dialog box, and I start pushing my shadows up, what happens is the shadow areas get really murky and they don't cooperate the same way that the shadow values would in, say, Photoshop. Because in Photoshop, when you modify or tweak the shadows and highlights, it's done in a way where the algorithm is responding to how the midtones are as well. And if you tweak your highlights, your midtones should also be tweaked to a certain extent so you don't get any fringing on the borders. But with the algorithm here, what happens if you start tweaking your shadows and highlights, it starts looking very mediocre. Mm. So you're not able to push your raw file to the point where you're used to as you would in another raw processor. So I think they have a lot of tweaking to do. Now, I think the good side to this program is that if you want to start learning how to edit your photos, it is a pretty viable option. Or if you don't modify your raw file so much, which I've seen a lot of photographers just open the file and start working, then this might be an okay option for you if you don't have the money to spend monthly. It makes it pretty reasonable. The other thing is I notice on options like clarity, if you start modifying your clarity slider, it's very similar to how Photoshop used to operate and how their algorithm was before. In that with clarity, there used to be a lot of haloing that would happen on an image when you start applying clarity to the photo. But they eventually fixed that problem with CS6 and CC. But with Affinity, there was still that issue where you got a lot of haloing happening across the image with clarity as well. So I can definitely tell that the algorithm is kind of, it needs updating and needs support. But
it's
I think
young.
That's something that's...
Exactly. It's a young program. This is not entirely unexpected.
Yes.
Once you got out of RAW and started actually getting in there, and when you have to do the real hardcore retouching, how are the tools in there?
So once I actually hit commit and brought the file into the actual program, it's funny. I'm having a hard time saying or not saying Photoshop because for every few seconds I say the name Affinity, I feel like I want to say Photoshop in text. I'm so used to it. So that's one of those things that takes time to get used to. So I think the coolest part is their layout is pretty slick. On the right-hand side, you have your basic adjustments, you have your histogram, you have your typical panels or palettes that you're used to seeing, which makes it really user-friendly and intuitive. Surprisingly, they had everything that I was expecting in Photoshop. So for example, I can come here to my layers panel and I can set a new layer and I can set my brush, which is on the left-hand side where all the tools are, and I can select my healing brush. Now, the healing brush works pretty much exactly the same way that I would imagine using it in Photoshop as well, where you know, you basically want to remove an item or object that you don't want there. And all the shortcut commands are basically the same as well, which makes it really easy to use. So if you're familiar with Photoshop shortcuts, you can dive right in and get used to it right away. So I think that's great. The other really cool part is the fact that all the adjustments are stacked. So you're able to visually see what you want to do and get to it right away. So if you want to apply levels, you just click on the Levels tab and it brings up an adjustment layer on top of any blank layer and so forth. So it makes it pretty straightforward. I mean, I didn't see anything that I was lacking. Mm-hmm. It had everything that I basically wanted as far as editing goes. And if your workflow is really clean with retouching, it has everything you'd be looking for, which is, I think, you know, fantastic. Let's see what else.
So what you're saying is basically the thing that's holding it back is just the raw processor at this point.
Exactly. It even has 16
and
bits,
algorithms. So.
Well, that's okay. that's what I meant though. The algorithms that are powering the raw processor.
Yeah.
How is the healing brush? Does it and the clone stamp? Are they all just like perfect?
they do seem pretty much exactly what I was used to in Photoshop. You know, I tested it out and got to see how the flow and opacity was and stuff, and they had all the same settings, and it seemed to react the same way. Yeah, I didn't see a downside to using the clone brush or heating brush in comparison. I haven't done a full retouch on it, but from what I've been playing around with, it looked like it did a decent job. I think the so you know, some people also ask, why don't you just use GIMP because it has pretty much everything? Well, from the last I remember, I don't know if they've updated, but GIMP, I don't think, has 16-bit processing. This one does. So if you come over here to Document on the top panel, you can come to Color Format and change it to 16-bit as well, or 8-bit CMYK. It has a lab mode in case, you know, you're used to working in lab. Yeah, I think it's great. It even has a frequency separation preset. So if people are used to using, you know, frequency separation, you can come in and basically apply that without knowing how to use that, which is fantastic.
GIMP's been able to use 16-bit processing since May 2012, by the way.
Oh, so
It
you
has?
can.
Okay.
Okay.
So it shows how
Not
dated my GIMP
32-bit.
preferences have been.
I mean, no one's blaming you. I don't think I've ever opened GIMP or used it myself. So what you're
Pratik.
saying, wait, go ahead, Kamran.
Sorry. I was actually going to ask is could you like you said you haven't done a full retouch in Affinity yet, and I was wondering could you see yourself like what is holding you back from perhaps doing a full retouch? Like what hesitations, what reservations do you have that you see currently in Affinity that they would need to kind of spruce up before you could actually, make something to the equivalent of what you already do produce?
To be honest, right now, nothing seems to be holding me back. I think what is holding me back is raw support. So say a camera comes out next month and I need it to be compatible. Typically, because of CC, what happens is they send over their updated camera raw, which allows me to read raw files and so forth. But say you have Capture One or whatever processing program you use to process your raw files and then export it into TIFF or PSD. It's completely viable to retouch a photo from scratch using this program. So there actually isn't any reservations. I think the other thing is just because of industry standard and the fact that most people are using Photoshop is why I stick to it. And just because of funding and support, knowing that with Photoshop there's a lot more R&D money that goes into it. So, you know, say there's features that come out in the future, I am able to stay on top of it. So Affinity may be good right now, but say a year from now, they might not be as current as Photoshop will be.
So one of the things I think I could probably compare this to is I used to be a graphic designer, and what we would get, we would support from clients anything that you could do it in, from Quark, if anyone is a graphic designer today, if you remember Quark,
I
to
remember Quark.
InDesign. So I think maybe what Affinity's first-hand goal would be is to be put on that list of supported platforms that people would know
Yes.
how to use. And based on your
Exactly.
description, it seems like they actually aren't too far from that.
No, they aren't. And it seems like they've done a really good job of getting user support because, you know, with all the attention that they're getting in the media, they do seem to have a potential to, you know, get a lot of funding, I would say. Not funding, but just a big support group or a user group that allows them to do it.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly have the public. Most, a lot of the public polling for them. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. I didn't ask you to do this, but I'm going to ask you to do it right now. If you had to give this program a star
Yes.
amount out of 5 stars, keeping in mind that it is indeed a beta, how many stars would Pratik give Affinity Photo?
I'll definitely give them 4 stars.
Solid
Definitely.
four. That's pretty good because that's
It's
generally like
promising.
when I say a product, for me, almost no product is perfect. So I
No.
generally get a 4-star. Giving Affinity a 4-star for a beta
Yes.
from Pratik, that's a big deal.
The only thing that's actually holding me back is the fact that it sometimes does crash. So,
It's a
yeah. So
beta.
does Photoshop. What are you trying to say?
Yeah, I mean Premiere crashes on me pretty regularly now.
I need consistency. So far, Photoshop hasn't really crashed on me that much, so I've been really lucky. I'm gonna count
Better
my
not knock on
blessings.
some wood there, Pratik.
Yeah, I'm gonna knock on all the wood.
All right, cool. Thank you, Pratik, for walking us through that. We appreciate it. So, as if you, one more time, 4 stars out of
Yeah,
five.
my pleasure. And if you guys have any questions, feel free to email me at solsticeretouch@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to answer them as much as I can.
Oh, man. Hope the floodgates don't open for you there, buddy.
Pratik, as a retoucher, something happened. Me and Jared, we covered this last week on our show, that there were these purposely leaked unretouched photos of these celebrities. I think Cindy Crawford was one. I don't remember who the others were, but I wanted to know from your perspective, you know, a big picture of like, you know, what's going on. Just break it down for us and explain from your point of view what you see going on here.
So this unretouched thing is very fascinating because a lot of people have demanded to see unretouched photographs of people. They want to see unretouched photographs of product campaigns, and they think it should represent realism. You know, I think generally the funny thing is that fashion or commercials are a place to escape realism. It's supposed to be a space of fantasy because, you know, when you buy a product or when you buy something, you have this illusion of what, you know, you'll look like wearing this product or what you would look like in the perfect situation. It's escape from reality. So what happened was eventually all photos started becoming retouched to a point where people weren't happy about it. So they decided to run by scenarios where they would release retouched photos in, say, magazines like American Eagle or Abercrombie, or a few campaigns had full sets where they would just say, hey, these photos are completely unretouched. We don't retouch our models anymore. But it was kind of an issue because they still made up for that by adding additional makeup or getting the lighting.
Yeah, lighting is huge. Like, lighting is a big player in how people look.
Exactly.
Lighting and makeup, and, yeah.
Yeah, and when you think about it, that's essentially retouching. Retouching isn't the last 3% of removing a blemish. It's how much makeup is applied, to what degree to hide these blemishes, how is lighting done to make a person look better. Or, you know, I think the general population will understand with analogy of taking selfies. Like, a lot of people take selfies and they won't take it at a certain angle. They'll change the angle. They'll change the way the light's being used in their little selfie, and they'll modify everything so that they look as good as possible. But instead of all this, they blame the retouching. And so what happened was people started using unretouched photos as a marketing vessel. They started releasing these photos saying that, you know, here are celebrities unretouched to give magazines a push in sales, but they use the guise of morality to release them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there are a few instances that this happened. One of them was, I think, a recent one with Cindy Crawford, where her photo was released unretouched. Now, there are a few theories on why it happened. Personally, I think one of the things that typically happens in a situation like this is either it's done purposefully. So I think it's done purposefully in situations because, like I said, they want to boost marketing or they want to boost the attention to the magazine. Mm-hmm. But it also happens without permission sometimes. And because you work in an area where the files get handed through many people, big sites like Jezebel, for example, would give money to people saying, hey, if you give us these photographs, we'll pay you X amount of money. And it's a lot of money.
Usually a ton of money.
Yeah. And if you are a retoucher, or if you are an assistant or somebody working in that office that has access to these files, you get paid a lot of money to give out these images. So, you know, either that happens. So one of those two things: you get a marketing push by companies to do this intentionally, or it's done by somebody for malicious intent. So that's kind of what my theory is behind seeing these photos distributed so heavily online, even though I don't think people really want to see it.
Yeah, I would think that of those two categories, the one where we have someone trying to do it for marketing purposes, I think would probably fall Cindy Crawford. And the one doing it where it was not necessarily in the best interest of anyone was the ones where there was like a ton of Beyonce came out, where she looks like a human. And
yeah.
Like, so people just, there's a fury, just a firestorm of commentary that comes out about this. And this whole idea of retouched, unretouched, I agree with you. This is this idea of using it for marketing. And it, like BuzzFeed did that video about how Photoshop changed the way people looked, and they did it to the extreme. And these women were like, oh, that's not me. And it's like, okay, yes, you can do that, but that's not, I don't think that's the goal of a true retoucher, is to change you from who you are.
Exactly. And I think what people don't understand is when we get these files from photographers, they don't actually look that far off from the retouch photo. And people are surprised to hear that, because they see these unretouched photos and they look awful. So I think what's happening is they're starting to release these really intentionally awful photos. But people don't stop to think about the fact that, you know, if you look at this from a photography standpoint, it's an awful photograph. Therefore, it really wouldn't actually be published even if it was retouched.
Right.
So that alone gives you a clue that these photographs that you're seeing are not actually the ones that would have been released retouched.
Yeah. And then we also get those weird cases of the Sports Illustrated cover where that retouch was just, I don't even understand how that got out. The Kate Upton one where her chin and her neck are like one item.
Yeah.
Clearly, the photographs aren't taken by any of the photographers who listen to this show.
No. All right, I got to mark that down. I got to mark it down. You cussed. I got to go in at 32 minutes. You said it again. 33 minutes. 32 and 33.
Oh, boy. Sorry about that. Sorry. Clearly, no crappy photographers that listen to this show. You just distracted me, Jared. Clearly, no crappy photographers that listen to this show took those photos.
Clearly,
because our listeners are awesome, and they're great photographers, and they look beautiful, and we like you.
Well, thank you for that, Pratik. That was good. That was good insight from someone who is not just, you know, looking at it from outside in. Like you're in there. You're in the trenches yourself. This is like this is what you do. So, like, it's good to hear it from you.
Yeah,
I'm buddies with Beyonce. I know this.
Oh, Jesus.
Don't be human.
Oh,
Beyonce.
My God, you said it again. I got it. 33 again. 33 is going to be riddled with beeps.
Oh, okay. All right. So let's just change gears a little bit, and let's talk about a show that's been on the air for a while called MythBusters.
A while is like an understatement. It's been on the air forever.
Yeah, it has been on the air forever, which is why they've rebooted this year, and they've had like, I don't know, 5 or 6 episodes already done and aired. Why is this important to us? It's because for their reboot, yes, they got rid of the maker staff, and they upgraded their camera gear to provide better quality visuals, and they're focusing more on process, which I love.
Yeah, and science. Know, they're focusing a lot on science.
Yes, these are good things. These are educational things, and I applaud them. And you know, we love BTS videos of photographers doing stuff, and that's showing their process. Chase Jarvis is one of the first people to do that. And I feel watching the new MythBusters, it is a beautifully entertaining and educational program, and you know they're doing good stuff over there. You know, they're
so Jared, when you say like they upgraded their cameras, they dumped the GoPros in lieu of a Blackmagic Cinema camera, pocket cinema camera, little ones,
small ones.
With like some high quality optics on there. And I know this because I was there when they received them, but they also have the new DJI Inspire 1s as their quadcopters, because I saw them actually get them gifted to them. They didn't even know that was going to happen. It was at the DJI Inspire event that they were at. And so I know that they have them, so they're probably using those too, especially since they're no longer using GoPros, so they can't use the old Phantoms that they were using. But the end result looks... I've watched 2 episodes now. I got them like syndicated on the Science Channel. And I watched them, and I found myself watching, like, unable to get off the couch or change the channel for both episodes, when before it was really easy for me to be like, okay, well, they've switched over to the Carrie and the Grant part, and I don't really care about that particular myth, so I'm going to go to the bathroom or I'm going to go cook dinner, and I can come back. And by the end of the show, I'll have the result to the myth that I was interested in. They're actually, like, busting and confirming all the way through the episode, which I think makes it a heck of a lot more watchable.
Yeah, and it's definitely not like link baity as it was before, where hey, we're going to show you this conclusion of this experiment at the end of the show.
Yeah, like
so keep watching.
He'll have his hands on the explosive detonator, and it'll be on its way down, and we don't see the result of that for 20 more minutes. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. Pratik, do you watch the show? Are you familiar with MythBusters?
I don't actually. I actually never used to watch it very much, but I know a lot of people like you guys who are so fascinated with the show. It's great to hear that. I wonder if they've changed their format, because a lot of shows have also changed the way they've done things. Like you mentioned, you know, like the guy was coming down with his explosive, but they won't show it 20 minutes later. People don't have the patience for that anymore. So they probably change up everything because of
Yeah,
it.
it's easier to just turn the channel off or change the channel if I'm not going to get what I want to see right now.
Exactly. The instant gratification type of mentality has changed everything from directing.
Yeah, the pace of the show I think has definitely increased because it feels like it's just chugging
Oh, yeah.
along. It's going well. They improve their graphics too, like all of the animations they use. There's a lot more science in them, and they're a lot more they're funnier to watch. Before they would just take like Adam or Jamie's head and put it like jib jab style on a body. They don't do that anymore. They actually have like legit animators animating like these characters that are
It's
fully
well done.
animated. Yeah, it's really well done. So if you haven't seen MythBusters yet, the new MythBusters. Definitely worth
Check
checking
it out.
out. Like I'm really
Yeah.
enjoying it. Again,
I
I'm
love
enjoying it
that they're
again like I
also.
did when it first aired.
Yeah. I think five or six episodes.
Not too
Yeah.
many.
But they're also Bay Area based, which is, we love it. Me and Jaren both also Bay Area based, so we love that. Okay, let's move on to the next story. Jaren, this is something you got very excited about. So we've seen handheld gimbals before from well, the one I'm specifically thinking about is the Nebula 4000. Last week I showed the iCan iFly X3 Plus. I forget the name, but I think that's it. But now we have this new one called Pilot Flight Tech, which I just discovered like randomly in this Facebook group. What do you make of this? What do you think, buddy?
So I think it was like what, maybe 2 days ago, they actually released a YouTube video that showed what GH4 footage. Okay, let me back up a little bit. They have this handheld gimbal for GoPro, and they might have one for cell phones too. So it's at the level of that iCan one right now. It's not. It was not really at the level of the Nebula, but now we see that they're building one specifically for cameras the size of the GH4. More specifically than that, the GH4, and
And also the A7S, yeah.
yeah, because they're about the same weight. I think the GH4 is even heavier, honestly. They were showing what it can do, and I've seen footage from the Nebula, and I've seen footage from this now. And if they price this thing right, I'm very impressed. I thought that it handled the up and down motion less good than the Nebula does. So you know, when you're stepping, you're naturally moving your arm up and down. And unless I think the cameraman lost his focus in or two or three places during this, but it you can clearly, in my mind, I'm in the world with him when he's walking around with this thing, and there's about two or three places where he pops me out of it because I notice there's a jitter in the camera work. And I don't necessarily blame the gimbal for this. I blame maybe the cameraman, but some of that might be able to be put on the gimbal because it's not able to compensate for what is basically unavoidable when you're out walking around with something that small. All of this said, what the price point, what they're saying was like thinking between $300 and $500.
Yeah, we have no idea, but if they come up to market with that, that's going to be awesome. I mean, it's a Chinese company.
How much does the Nebula cost?
700-ish
I
dollars,
know,
I
I know
think.
it was more than I wanted to spend.
Yeah. But hey, you can't mess with Pilotfly because yes, they already do make a three-axis gimbal for the GoPro, but they took it to the next level. They put it on a selfie stick so you can extend it out. Yeah, see, Pratik knows what I'm talking about. Like they, no joke, no messing with that. You have your little cell phone camera mount at the base, so you can actually see the framing of the GoPro to get it just right, and then you can take the picture with that. Like they're not messing around here. But although they do call it the Funny Go,
The
so I think
name
there's some
is
messing around with this.
such a
So bad,
bad name, the Funny Go.
the reason why we're excited about this journey is because this handheld gimbal technology coming down, you know, the
Yeah.
pipe to like cheaper prices and
I'm
getting
surprised how
awesome
quickly
quality
it's
video.
happening, honestly, because when the Nebula came out, I was like, what? Like, how is this possible? When you first saw the Nebula, Pratik, were you as like, I don't even believe this is happening?
No, even from somebody who wasn't from a videography background, I saw the implications of it and how amazing it was. 'Cause I didn't understand either. It looked like it would cost a lot more than it does.
Yeah, I mean, even though it was more than I wanted to spend at the time, like I shoot like the right now for the video feed that I'm doing right now. This is on my GH4 with a Sigma 18 to 35 on it, and I love this camera. And I like how small and compact it is. And to put something that small, and we keep getting smaller, and I love it.
Yes.
This is great. So I'm excited. I want to know how much this thing's gonna cost, and I'm gonna try and get one and play with it.
Yeah, speaking of things getting smaller.
Oh.
How about filmmaking with your iPad? So right, Apple just came. Apple released just this awesome commercial during the Oscars, narrated by Martin Scorsese, when he was giving a commencement speech at the NYU Tisch School of the Arts, class of 2014. And I applaud this. I love, you know, how, yeah, before you had to have like a camera and a whole crew to do this. Now you can set kids off and say, hey, just with the iPad, you can make a film. You can make a movie. And this is a great ad. And did you guys watch this?
I haven't seen the ad yet.
I haven't seen that either. But the only thing, it looks like from a production standpoint, it seems like, you know, they're marketing towards the whole production of from start to finish, from script writing to from the sound to getting the final editing look done. I just don't know how it would be for the recording process. I mean, if you're stationary for everything, that seems fine, but I don't know. It just doesn't feel like it would translate, but, you know, seemingly a lot of people might be taking it on board and trying it out. And
on that particular tangent, let me ask you, Karaminder, because we briefly discussed this last week, because I don't necessarily get as jazzed as you when it comes to shooting with a cell phone, because I don't think they're there yet. But you said, well, what about that Bentley commercial that was shot with an iPhone? So let me ask you, was this thing by Apple done in a similar fashion where they took the iPhone, and the iPhone was really only the capturing device, but the thing that made it look so good was the ridiculous amount of other things they put on top of it. Did they do that in this case too?
Yeah, so there's a number of cases where I see, you know, the iPod in a they use these special mounts that obviously can then have a quarter inch 20 thread at the bottom. So that way you can put it on a tripod. They put it on a dolly. Some kids go lo-fi where they sit their butt on a skateboard holding the iPad. And
yeah, and for that, I think that's awesome. I think it's putting filmmaking in the hands of everybody is fantastic.
Yes.
I just think it's easy to get carried. If you get carried away with it to the point of where you're expecting like someone who wants to make a really, really high-end looking film, I just don't think we're there yet.
Well, no. If you're going to make a high-end looking film, you're not going to use an iPad to do it. But
that's what they just did. They did it here, and they did it with the Bentley.
Oh, but they did it very well. And I think everyone's definition of what is high-end looking or not, because there is no shallow depth of field, although they did use I think it's called an N-focus depth of field adapter on the Bentley shoot. The great thing is that these options are available. I mean, hey, Jaren, you use a speed booster, right?
I'm using that's one right now.
Yeah, that's a great way to get kind of a bigger look of a fuller frame sensor, I should say, not full frame, but a bigger sensor look to a smaller sensor camera using a tool like that. And yeah, the great thing is it's almost like soup to nuts on an iPad where, yeah, Pratik, they show you can use screenwriting software, and then they use Filmic Pro for video capturing. Then you can record sound and do your sound mixing in GarageBand and with an Apogee mic you can buy from an Apple store. Then grade it with these apps that are available in the App Store. Because most people probably have quicker access to an iPad than they would an Alexa Mini or a Blackmagic Pocket or anything like that.
Go ahead, Pratik.
You know, looking at this from outside perspective, it kind of gives inspiration to people like me who probably wouldn't necessarily get into video because it's so overwhelming to, you know, say, oh, God, I have to buy all this equipment. I have to, you know, get this and this and this. But with this, it seems like just having a good base, it's so much easier to get into, especially if I only need, say, two or three more things to make a whole production together. It seems like I would do something like this.
That I can
get behind. The barrier to entry is a lot lower and therefore can allow more people to get in. And the whole point of, you know, when you listen to the ad, it's inspiring to be a filmmaker without having to, you know, maybe go to film school. I mean, I know it's a good thing. Hey, guys, education is good. I'm not trying to tell you anything other than that. But these students at Los Angeles County High School for the Arts, they're the ones that were tasked with like making these videos. And you can go to the website, and we have a link in the blog description on resourcemagonline.com. And you can see the little videos that they've made and the creativity that these kids have with, you know, some of them have like use gels for lighting, using a skateboard to get a more moving dynamic shot. Like, this is creative stuff using kind of very good equipment. I'm saying good because I think the lens on the iPhone and on the iPads are good for this. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. And
so despite me being dubious on the best uses of this software, I do have to say that there is one case where Resource Magazine has done an entire behind the scenes video on an iPad, and it was for the Profoto B1s. I think it was last year that they did this, but Alex, the owner and president of Resource Magazine, went out with Michael Corsentino, and she shot this entire thing on her iPad and edited the entire thing on her iPad using an app that is basically like Adobe Premiere on an iPad, because iMovie is not robust enough. And I honestly was impressed by this. And I think that's the kind of thing where I can be like, yeah, all right, you did it.
And don't forget, one of the most important parts of this process, distribution. From the actual device, you can upload it to Vimeo, upload to YouTube, soup to nuts here. And, you know, for some of you guys don't know this, but you may have saw my face on this video where me and Peter Hurley were showing people how to accentuate the jaw. We shot that on an iPhone 4S. The entire thing is shot on an iPhone 4S. No one really knows. We never did a BTS film because we didn't think no one would watch it. We edited an iMovie on a Mac, like, and then we got it out. It's really simple. And we use good lighting, of course, but that's how we did it. And I love seeing more of this. And this actually kind of leads into our last story, which was kind of a thought piece by Vincent Lafore. And Vincent Lafore, you may heard of his name. Reverie, when the Canon 5D Mark II came out, which he himself has proclaimed it the world's worst cologne ad, but showcased what you could do with a DSLR for filmmaking at the time. And it's just funny because Lafore has always been a photographer and actually worked, I want to say New York Times, as a journalist, and then got known for doing video. And then he got into a helicopter, shot a bunch of...
Yeah, now he's being known for his Above series. We went above New York and he went above Las Vegas.
Which he calls Lafore Air, which he actually does in San Francisco. He hasn't released it yet, but we're going to talk about that
in
a second.
Did he really come over here? Is that why his picture on his blog is in San Francisco?
I'll tell you that in a second. So he wrote this thought piece about, title is Prediction, The Age of the Standalone Still Camera is Coming to an End for All But Pros. And so what he's saying is that kind of, you know, change is already in the wind. You know, iPhone is already the most popular camera out there for capturing moments, and it's always with you. And the fact that you can take, you know, the software in them, so you can take panoramas, and then you can actually quickly share them. He talks about a specific case where he did the Air NYC photos, and it got published for a magazine, or it was for a magazine he made those photos. Didn't get a call, didn't get a blip, didn't get nothing. He put it out on storehouse.com, which is a more social storytelling website, and it went viral and exploded, and now he has a year-long project covering different cities all around the world for this project. And it was
with sponsors.
Of course, that's where it came from. But the point he's saying is that going traditional old media didn't help. But when he put it on, say, new media, storehouse.com, Snapchat, Twitter, whatever, Facebook, that's where he got the big reaction from. And so the point he's trying to make is that, you know, your phone, which I have a clunky case, your phone, you know, is already with you. It's so ubiquitous, and it has the ability already to like post to these services and to get it out there. Whereas our kind of clunky cameras, you know, they don't have the ability. I mean, some of these cameras are not coming with Wi-Fi, and so they're a little bit more connected, but they're still going to connect to this in order to do anything. And the point he's making is that this trajectory is already happening, guys. It's a matter of like getting on board, getting on train, and kind of going with the flow as photographers as we are. But pros, people who still need lenses, people who still need to make something for a professional result, are really the only ones who are going to buy DSLRs. He makes another example of the Samsung NX1, which is technically an amazing camera, shoots 4K. First camera to do H.265, which Jaren will talk about in a second. And but nobody's paying any attention to this camera. What do you, Jen, you want to say something?
I've had some recent frustrations with the Samsung NX1.
Yes. But what about the overall idea, what I'm trying to talk about? Vincent LaFori's talking about, which is that
it's hard to disagree with the
habits
guy.
Are changing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm that guy who really, when I want to take a picture, I really want to take a picture. So I have my really nice camera for that. But generally speaking, when I go on vacation or if I'm out just hanging, I only have my cell phone and I'm taking pictures with this thing regularly. And I mean, I'm not the kind of guy who's constantly posting, but I do appreciate the freedom to have everything in one device. I don't have the newest one. I have seen the newest iPhone and how good the pictures and video and how the low light is actually surprisingly good. And I think they're only going to get better. I do agree that, and I don't mind this. I don't mind that he thinks that DSLRs and higher end gear are only going to be reserved for the pros. That's fine with me. I have no problem with that.
Especially with somebody like me who used to shoot more often and now has progressed on the retouching side. I shoot less frequently, but I still need a camera. And what I've found is even on my travels, even though I take my camera with me, I end up taking a lot more photos with my cell phone because of the fact that it's so accessible in areas that I just don't want to take out my camera from laziness or the fact that I think my phone would be good enough.
Yeah, what if the environment isn't like, ooh, I really wish I could get a picture of this, but I don't want to scare anyone off when I whip out my 24-70 on my DSLR.
Exactly.
So, I mean, yeah, I can see where he's coming from, and I have no problem with the direction. You mentioned that NX1, so I will briefly talk about it. I struggled for a while last week with that camera, and I think my main issue with it right now, I'm still reviewing it, I have not come to a final conclusion, but because it only shoots in H.265, it means you can't watch it on an iMac or a Macintosh product of any type, or edit it in Adobe as it is, because Adobe does not yet support H.265. So it was just beyond frustrating, because then I had to find a way to convert, transcode it down to H.264, which of course lowers the quality of the footage. So what's the point here? I also have a few little nitpicky things with it, but I think I liked that Samsung wanted to go this direction, but I can see LaFori's point here that, you know, as cool as the gear in this thing is, it's not necessarily as news grabby as maybe they thought it could be.
Well, I guess it's not news grabby, but I think it's more, I'm just going to quote him here. He says like, he says, and that's the point. It's not necessarily about the search for the best camera. It's a challenge to make the most popular and widely adopted camera.
Mm-hmm.
And smartphones have already won that battle.
Yeah,
I
don't think there's any way to unseat them at this point.
Yeah. And the whole point is it's just something that's with you all the time. You can quickly take a picture, and it's more about, say, storytelling and publishing than it was about the technical excellence of a photograph, you know. Yeah, and
you know, here's what I want in the next iPhone. Yeah. I want a micro SD card slot. I think the main reason I don't shoot a lot with mine is because I don't like the workflow of getting stuff off that phone, and I'm always concerned that I leave too much on it. If I had a micro SD that I could pop out the same way that I'm used to on my cameras right now, and just throw it inside my Lexar hub and pull everything out of it, then I think I would be way more open to this. For some reason, I have not plugged my iPhone into my computer in probably a year, and I don't care to, and I don't want to, and because my plug is in my bedroom next to my bed where I charge it every night, and I wanted to pull it out and walk all the way to my computer, put it in, move things around. That's my problem with it right now. It's stupid and lazy, but that's my problem. So
but that's okay though, because
I think that's okay.
Yeah, and everyone's in the same ballpark, I think, is, you know, if you can make things as simple as possible, it's not really lazy, it's more about just efficiency.
Yeah, and so you Android users out there, you probably don't feel this pain because you do have a micro SD card slot.
Exactly. I'm looking at
but
you
I
like,
don't
wait
think that's. I don't think that's such a big deal. Well, I understand what you're saying. I understand your pain, Jaren, but like your camera, when you take something, video, photos, there's two ways to get it out. The old way, which is a removable media card, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a new way. Some of these cameras have Wi-Fi.
Oh, so you no can way.
Actually, yeah, well, you can actually just get the images that way.
I've found that I actually do that right now with the stuff on my phone. I back it up to my NAS and I back it up on Dropbox. But it's the process with Apple is weird because it doesn't let it go in the background when the screen is black. Like as soon as this goes black, about like a minute later, it cuts you off. So you have to keep turning it back on, which is really annoying. Another thing that Android does better. I like how your response to that, Pratik, like, oh, it does that? That sounds so weird.
Yeah, I'm like, what is that?
So, yeah. No.
But look at your phone, though, how many ways you can get media off of the phone. Yeah you can plug it in.
Yeah.
But you have all these different apps. You can, if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, download the Amazon Prime Photos app or the Amazon Photo app, and you can actually back up all your photos for free. To Amazon, yeah, you have to watch out for the backup thing, which you just mentioned, Jaren, when it goes to sleep. And
yeah, I'm just saying, I have to baby this thing if I want to get anything off it. When I'm just used to pulling, popping, dragging, and leaving, until then I come back in 10 minutes and it's done.
But as far as workflow, the point is workflow, right? So
yeah,
you capture it with the iPhone, you can actually send to Twitter, send to Instagram, upload to Snapchat. You can all do that from the camera without having to. You don't have to download to computer, process, and then export, and then upload. Like, you don't have to. It's connected, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I'm just saying I'm lazy and I want it a certain way. And I'm sure I don't have to wait long. With the changes that Apple is making with their products, I'm sure I don't have to wait long for these things I'm asking for. And the technology that supports it is only going to get better.
Probably by the 8S where you'll get what you want.
Yeah, it'll be a while, right? It'll be a while.
The way I see this, guys, is where people who buy, you know, the Rebel, the T6i kind of variant of cameras, like these starter, even mirrorless maybe, these kind of smaller cameras that people kind of buy and afford, that they just go on vacation, they take some pictures, and then they're like, oh, I got to download them, and then I have to... figure it out and have to mail it, right? I think all that is gonna, like what Vincent LaFour is saying, it's gonna just kind of disappear, just like point and shoots did.
Yeah, well, I mean, point and shoots, we're seeing them dying. There's very few uses for them now, although you can still use them. The video quality on some of those things still will outperform an iPhone or an Android phone, but we're already seeing those dying off, and I think it's a very logical conclusion to see their big brothers die off as well as the technology for smaller things gets better. All right, I think we're out of time, guys, but Pratik, thank you so much for joining us this week. We really enjoyed having you on. We have to call
you. Thank you, Pratik.
We're gonna have to call you back
from
again.
London, by the way.
Yeah, he's calling in from Oxford. Hello. Right,
well, Oxford, sorry.
Oxford, that's London. Right,
he's from the south. Close enough.
When you come out here to California, we'll get you on again, get you in person.
Absolutely. It'll be really fun.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. If you have any comments or questions, you can reach us on Twitter at @ReWrapPodcast and always at resourcemagonline.com. Pratik, you're Solstice Retouch on Twitter, right?
That's correct. Solstice Retouch at Twitter.
Well, and I'm Jaren Schneider. He's @Caraminder. And this has been Podcast ReWrap. We'll see you all here next week.